a federal stimulus project for rural Alaska.
Comparable high-speed broadband that you would see in urban areas of the state for comparable prices.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 21st of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a common theme in the recent street deaths in Anchorage.
They have found only one substance that could be either a primary or an underlying factor in their deaths, and that is alcohol.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give.
And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu.
One fisherman is dead and three are safe after their fishing boat sank in the Gulf of Alaska yesterday evening. The 75-foot Northern Belle went down about 50 miles south of Montagu Island, or 235 miles northeast of Kodiak. The Seattle-based Northern Belle was bound for a cannery in Dillingham with supplies for the upcoming fishing seasons before heading to Togiak to tender during the herring fishery. The deceased man has been identified as the boat's skipper, Rob Royer. He reportedly suffered head injuries while abandoning ship and was dead when Coast Guard rescuers arrived about 2 hours later. The three crew members that survived, two men and one woman, suffered from hypothermia but are recovering. The cause of the sudden sinking is unknown and will be investigated, but crewman Robert Jack told the Seattle Times that Royer was concerned the boat was overloaded. Weather conditions were reasonably calm for the Gulf of Alaska, with winds of 10 miles per hour and seas of 3 to 5 feet. The Coast Guard Hercules found the crew in the water almost 2 hours after the Mayday call, clinging to debris, and dropped a life raft to them. The helicopter arrived around 8 p.m. and had all four crew members hoisted aboard within 40 minutes. They delivered them to Cordova just past 9. Another high-speed internet project is coming to the Bethel and Dillingham area in southwest Alaska. GCI has announced it was awarded $88 million in federal stimulus funds to speed up and expand their existing service in rural Alaska. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
GCI already operates an expansive network of wireless microwave towers in southwestern villages. It's called DeltaNet, and those towers can communicate with each other at high speed, but that's about where the high speed ends. Craig Johnson is GCI's Director of Rural Broadband Development.
That DeltaNet network itself is really an island in Alaska.
Everything in DeltaNet must be funneled out of the region to a satellite, which has created basically a digital bottleneck. GCI's plan to remedy this is called Terra Southwest Network. The backbone of the project is a new fiber optic cable, which will run from Homer across Cook Inlet to Pedro Bay and onto Leavelock in the Bristol Bay region. That fiber optic cable will be the new internet highway out of southwest Alaska. GCI will also construct new microwave towers in about a dozen Bristol Bay villages, which will link up to the DeltaNet towers already up in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The result, says Johnson, will be real high-speed connectivity for the whole region.
What this network is going to provide is comparable high-speed broadband to consumers and to businesses that you would see in urban areas of the state for comparable prices.
GCI says the Terra Southwest project became feasible after the Department of Agriculture awarded the company a $44 million grant and another $44 million in loans through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. GCI says work is already underway and the project will be complete in 2012. GCI is now the third company with plans to bring high-speed internet to the Southwest. The Sea Lion Corporation was also awarded stimulus money to create a high-speed 4G network, and the Kodiak Kenai Cable Company is planning on laying a fiber-optic cable in waterways across Alaska's western coast. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Autopsy results are pending on a fifth homeless inebriate found dead on Anchorage streets. Anchorage police and social services leaders point to alcohol as the culprit behind the deaths, but some say the city could do a better job in providing help for those who need it most. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Anchorage Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker came right out and said it.
We've seen in some of the blogs that people tend to want to group these together, and there's an impression out there that there's some person going around killing street folks.
Parker spoke in response to rumors posted on local blogs. He said the only serial killer out there is alcohol.
All of these people are being autopsied by the medical examiner's office. They also do toxicology results. Now, that takes up to 6-8 weeks to get the toxicology back. But on all of the toxicology screens that they've done with victims that have been found deceased outdoors within the last 12 months, they have found only one substance that could be either a primary or an underlying factor in their deaths, and that is ethanol, alcohol, grain alcohol.
Parker says autopsy results on the fifth homeless person found dead in Anchorage may be available late today. Genevieve Wilson, aged 54, was found in a junked car Sunday night, the latest in a string of homeless victims who died alone in the cold. Parker said police will be meeting with the state medical examiner's office regarding all the most recent victims.
We need to make sure from the law enforcement public safety perspective that we know exactly why it is that they died, and if there are any factors or underlying circumstances that we as a police department can help change.
Meanwhile, social services workers are planning to host a gathering Thursday at Beans Cafe, a soup kitchen located next to the Brother Francis Shelter in Anchorage. Susan Bumalowski is executive director of Catholic Social Services, which operates the shelter. Bumalowski says five deaths among the homeless in less than a month is not unusual, nor is the dozen homeless deaths publicized last summer.
Actually, the number of deaths of people, of homeless individuals in camps, et cetera, is really closer to 40 during the year. Those, you know, dozen deaths got publicity because of the time of year, the visibility. But every year at Beans Cafe and also at Brother Francis Shelter, you know, we honor those people that have passed away. So there are more than that.
She says the common thread among the deaths is alcohol.
It seems like a similar pattern. People that are physically at risk, at danger of the elements, are putting themselves in harm's way again. So what it tells me is we need to be doing something different.
Brother Francis Shelter is a damp shelter. It accepts inebriates, but residents cannot drink once inside. They can stay 30 days. Bumalowski says one of the problems social services providers encounter is a street culture that makes it difficult for a homeless individual to separate from the street community. Some homeless won't accept moving into a shelter for that reason. Bumalowski says last year's spate of homeless deaths prompted some changes in Brother Francis's protocols regarding residency.
We changed some of our policies to try to get people into the shelter that maybe normally wouldn't come. They could come in, they can take showers, they can do their laundry, to try to engage them in what we have provided there.
The shelter provides caseworkers for homeless residents who want them, and medical outreach is available as well. A city proposal regarding housing for homeless that would allow drinking on premises is now under discussion as a way to bring homeless off the streets and into a safe environment. Bumalowski says Thursday's meeting at Beans Cafe is aimed at providing information to the homeless about the dangers of hypothermia. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The state is fighting a wildfire near Anderson. Division of Forestry Information Officer Maggie Rogers says the fire was reported late last night about 5 miles south of the Parks Highway community.
Roughly 2 acres. It's in the Southwind Homestead, and it's within a dozer line that was created around the subdivision last year to protect that subdivision from encroaching fire.
Rogers says firefighters from Anderson began working the blaze immediately last night, with a state crew and engine joining the effort today. The fire is burning in the vicinity of homes and suspected to be human-caused. Rogers says conditions are ripe for fire.
It was wind-driven, and it was in dry grass and then hardwoods with some spruce. And thankfully, it looks like this one's going pretty well, but we are at the beginning of a season and we are pretty dry, especially here in the interior.
Rogers says there have been several small human-caused fires around the state in recent days. She says the pre-greenup period is always subject to fire starts as snow recedes and underlying dead vegetation quickly dries out. Lower than normal snowpack in some places is allowing things to dry out more quickly this spring. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, commemorating Petersburg's 100-year anniversary.
We were just kind of sitting around saying, how can we commemorate this? And I don't even know who came up with the idea of a community photo, but we all just went, yes, we can do it. We can pull it off.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
There's nearly $1 million in the state capital budget for creation of a state veterans cemetery in Fairbanks. State Representative David Guttenberg, who shepherded the project through the legislature for several years, says the commitment of state money prioritizes it for support from the Federal Veterans Administration.
Putting that money in the budget moves our vet cemetery to the top of the list that the VA has. And since we're one of the few states without a state veterans cemetery, we're going to get some priority.
Guttenberg says the VA will reimburse the state for the entire cost of the project after it's completed. He says negotiation for the purchase of land for the Veterans Cemetery is in the works. More bills failed than passed during the legislative session that just ended. Many affected a small number of people or proposed a minor change that can wait until another year. But one measure that raised a lot of interest, pro and con, was a proposal to eliminate daylight savings time. Opposition to the bill was especially strong in Southeast Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The first skirmish in Lynn Willis's battle against daylight savings time came about 10 years ago.
I was dutifully changing my clock, and I hung a clock back up on the wall, but I didn't do it correctly, and it fell off and broke. And I don't know if you'd call that an epiphany, but what am I doing this for?
Willis, who works in Anchorage's air cargo industry, began researching the issue, and he came to the same conclusion as many other Alaskans, that springing forward and falling back doesn't make sense this far north.
It's safer to work in the light, and when you're working out on airport ramp, if you can have daylight, it makes it a lot safer. It makes it safer to commute. And in the springtime, when we make that transition, for about 2 or 3 weeks, we're back in the dark.
He started a website, endalaskadaylightsaving.com, and added his voice to legislative attempts to make the change. But a bill trying to do just that failed this session, as they have for the past 10 years. That's in part because plenty of folks like daylight savings time.
There are still people in Ketchikan who are unhappy with the change back in 1983 where we zipped back to be on Anchorage time.
That's Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mayor Dave Kiefer. He says springing forward and falling back is a business issue for his town.
We have always traditionally done more of our commerce and business and connectivity with the Seattle area and the West Coast. And there's no question, we were definitely not happy with the plan to move even farther away.
Businesses elsewhere, and not just in Southeast, also expressed strong objections, and coaches and parents said the loss of afternoon daylight would impact recreation. Petersburg resident Don Cornelius testified before his town's council voted to oppose the legislation.
Somebody was commenting about the effects on Little League games. Games will have to be a little bit earlier and finish earlier, so by an hour. And then mental health, I think, is going to be a big issue here because we haven't got time to go out on picnics.
The bill passed the House last year, and its author, Eagle River Representative Anna Fairclough, continued the push. She even presented studies suggesting eliminating daylight savings time could improve school attendance, reduce heart attacks, and make chickens more likely to lay eggs. But the measure remained stalled in a Senate committee, where it stayed through session's end. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Mayor Dan Sullivan happily described the municipality's share of the statewide capital budget today at his weekly press conference. But Sullivan says keeping those legislative-approved dollars will require some lobbying. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Mayor Sullivan is extremely pleased with the fate of this year's Anchorage Legislative Capital Project list.
We did very, very well in Juneau on all fronts.
That could be an understatement. When one tallies not only the municipality capital projects, along with dozens of smaller requests from such entities as various nonprofits and even individual schools, Anchorage's cut of the total $3 billion-plus capital budget is over $560 million. The $3 billion includes $1 billion of federal money. Sullivan has high praise for the Anchorage legislators who slid these projects into the capital budget, as well as administration members who lobbied the city's cause during the just-concluded legislative session. Some of the municipality's big-ticket items include $20 million for the Port of Anchorage expansion project, $75 million for an Alaska crime lab, $11 million for rebuilding and renovation of two fire stations, over $4.5 million for LUSAC library repairs and improvements, and six major road projects with a combined total of over $40 million. Sullivan told the Assembly the challenge now is to get the funding to Anchorage. After all, Governor Parnell has line-item veto powers and has already expressed displeasure with what he considers a bloated statewide capital budget.
We're going to try and get together with the governor as soon as possible and go over what he's thinking, just find out what he's thinking first and see if we can't maybe suggest some areas that would be least impactful to us.
But Sullivan, who's had to handle some major expenditure reductions as mayor, knows small item cuts will not likely satisfy the governor's goals.
I know to really make any dent in a budget that's in the billions, you know, you're probably going to have to look at some big ticket items, and there are certainly ones for Anchorage.
Sullivan describes some possible gubernatorial targets that could require administration lobbying.
The port at $20 million, the crime lab, $75 million. The school or the university sports center, some of those are going on bonds, and so he may want to leave the bonds alone, but we're definitely going to have that discussion.
Governor Parnell has 20 days, not counting Sundays, from when he receives the capital budget to make his line item vetoes. It must arrive at his desk in time to act before the fiscal year starts on July 1, 2010, but there's no deadline to send it to him. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Elfin Cove-based Eagle Charters will pay tens of thousands of dollars after pleading guilty to charges that four of its fishing guides were caught overfishing during a state sting operation. Undercover officers booked a fishing trip with Eagle Charters from August 30th to September 2nd, 2009. According to court documents, four different skippers on four different days engaged in overfishing activities and falsified logbook entries detailing the number of fish caught. The guilty plea was entered Tuesday Tuesday afternoon before Sitka Superior Court Judge David George. As part of the plea deal, Eagle Charters received a fine of $150,000, with $90,000 suspended. The company will pay the remaining $60,000 in 4 installments. Eagle Charters managing member Joe Kulavik says that without the sting operation, he might not even have been aware of the problem.
You know, I employ a lot of captains because I own 3 lodges. So with having 9 captains out there, there's a lot of competition between my captains. And I was not aware that this competition had gotten to the point where we had gotten ourselves to a point that we shouldn't be in the law enforcement.
Kulavik says his company will work to be better stewards of natural resources in the future. The state will return the company's 4 vessels, which were seized, for evidence. The U.S. Coast Guard investigated a reported oil sheen in the Northern Lynn Canal earlier this week. They found no sign of the substance, but did track down the probable source. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell reports.
Several Haines residents reported seeing oil on water surfaces from Viking Cove to Pyramid Island.
The slick was like this colorful sheen on the water with a scum line on it.
Don Wright was one of the people who witnessed and reported the oil sheening. He was a passenger in a plane flying from Juneau to Haines on Saturday.
And it reached various areas out into the canal, and it just kept going, and there would be these singular bodies of it floating with different long arms of it pouring into the different various bays and going around the islands and stuff like that.
Wright notified the National Response Center, which contacted the Coast Guard, the federal on-scene coordinator for maritime spills in Alaska. Operations Section Chief Chris Kimmery with the Coast Guard says the group sent a chartered helicopter along a route the oil would have likely traveled and talked to people in Haines. They found no more reports or signs of oil, but notified the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration of the investigation. The Coast Guard is also overseeing a planned cleanup project currently in progress at the wreckage of the Princess Kathleen at Lena Point between Juneau and Haines. Captain Melissa Burt is with the Coast Guard's Kathleen Project. The state organized the cleanup because they suspected that the ship has periodically released small amounts of unrecoverable oil in the years since its sinking.
Well, we were getting more reports on emulsified black oil coming up in the wreck site. So we felt like we were getting more reports than in the past, and we were able to see that those were attributed to the Princess Kathleen. The fact that there's a lot of freestanding oil in the vessel itself, that tells us that, you know, oil has been escaping over time.
The cleanup project began last year, and the latest phase of the cleanup, the part that actually vacuums the oil from the wreckage, started last weekend. By Monday, workers had removed almost 17,000 gallons of an oil and water mix. The site crew confirmed early on that the oil was leaking by using an ROV underwater remote camera about the size of a lunchbox.
We were able to float that through the vessel remotely and take some pictures, and that did show some free-floating oil and gave us sort of a generalized picture of what was going on down there. It also showed us how it was sitting in the water.
But Burt says although sheening was expected at the outset of the project, hearing about sightings in the Upper Lynn Canal was not.
We're not really seeing much oil released. I think the reports of sheening have been very, very minor. And we're actually going to do some overflights today with our aircraft to see what has been reported. But I'm not thinking that this is going to be a huge issue. I mean, I'm hoping that's not going to be the case. We're taking so many precautions.
According to oil experts from the Coast Guard's National Strike Force, it takes only a tablespoon of oil to produce a major rainbow-colored sheen. The actual sheen, if collected, would be measured in tenths of a millimeter. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Petersburg celebrated its centennial anniversary Tuesday afternoon with a massive group photo. The mayor declared a half-day holiday, and local organizers estimate as many as 1,500 people, roughly half the population, turned out to the ball fields for the panoramic picture. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein gathered some of the voices and sounds from the brief but historic event.
Some of those people in the back need to come over and fill in over here on the right.
We need a few catchers in right field. We're a little thin over there, so feel free to slide over towards right field.
I'm Ryan McFarlane, the Parks and Rec Director, and also on the Centennial Committee. And we've got a good portion of the elementary school, looks like, already filed in up here, and a number of adults starting to file onto the fields. It's colorful and happy crowd. And the way that the picture's going to be taken is we're going to take a number of photos and stitch them together so that there's more detail so we can actually see individual faces and things like that.
Like a panorama.
Absolutely.
I'm Sally Dwyer, and I'm a member of the Centennial Committee. We were just kind of sitting around saying, how can we commemorate this? And I don't even know who came up with the idea of a community photo, but we all just went, yes, we can do it. We can pull it off. We know we can.
I know there's a lot of people here, so you have to be quiet to hear me. All right. We need to do a couple things to make this photo turn out nicely. One, we need to fill in. Everybody except for the front row needs to kind of squish together a little closer, close up some of that space.
Tell me, what do you think Petersburg will look like in 100 years?
I think it'll pretty much look the same.
Yeah? How about you? Any thoughts?
A ghost town.
I think it might, yeah, look the same, but some stores might be shutting down.
Maybe like less trees, more trees cut down.
I think it'll be a really big city.
I sure hope all the paths and the hiking trails will still be here, and maybe we'll have our Bible church built by then.
In 100 years, I think there'll be more road, less forest.
Keep looking at the camera. So, Tanya Somerville, photographer, tell me about how things went.
Things went good. Yeah, Ryan, we were able to communicate by walkie-talkie, and so I was able to tell him what I was seeing from up above, and then he was able to shift people. It's not perfect with that big of a group. You know, the cemetery won't be perfect, but it's pretty good.
What do you think Petersburg will look like in 100 years?
Well, I hope it's just as beautiful as it is right now, and I really don't want to see it grow much more than it is, so I hope it looks a lot like it is now.
Those were some of the voices from Tuesday's centennial photograph at the Ball Fields in Petersburg. The city was incorporated on April 20th, 1910. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com.
And by
North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you file for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. Volunteer firefighting is a rewarding and extraordinary way to serve your community. It takes dedication, sacrifice, leadership, as well as mental and physical stamina. Emergency calls throughout Alaska continue to rise, but the number of volunteer firefighters continues to decline. Learn how you can experience the excitement and satisfaction of becoming a volunteer firefighter. Visit asfafireline.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska State Firefighters Association. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.